Territorialization. Territories in imperial history. Territorialization denotes how the status and rights associated with fiefs became fixed in specific lands. The term derives from Leopold von Ranke in 1839, who distinguished political development at the level of the principalities from that at national level. Like feudalization, the term is both useful and problematic. Ranke's distinction proved fundamental in entrenching the dualist interpretation of the empire being eaten from within, as the principalities supposedly usurped the emperor's powers. It implies that territorialization was unwanted, driven instead by princes who placed their own interests above those of the nation. The customary linkage of territory to state adds to this, suggesting a federalization of the empire as a loose association of what became de facto independent states. Similar problems stem from the strong contemporary tradition of regional history, which traces the development of the modern German federal states, Bundesländer, from the various principalities, counties, and cities once occupying their current space. Territorialization was a feature of the entire empire, and not just those principalities large enough to appear on the pages of historical atlases. The process emerged from the wider adjustments of power outlined in the preceding section, and which represented a division of labor within the elite's collective responsibility for the empire. The emperor upheld the empire's overall integrity, pursued the imperial mission, and offered leadership along the lines of idealized kingship. The princely elite exercised more local responsibilities for order and justice through their political self-sufficiency. They were expected to carry out their tasks without the emperor's supervision or assistance. Territorialization developed to enable them to achieve this, thus complementing rather than contradicting imperial authority. The late medieval and early modern conflicts between emperors and princes remained largely personal, not constitutional. The exercise of jurisdiction had always entailed some sense of spatial limits, though this was complicated by the fact that authority was often over people, not places. As earlier chapters have indicated, the original duchies were not understood by their inhabitants as having precise frontiers. The feudalization of vassalage helped change conceptions of space and authority, encouraging the reconfiguration of the empire's internal order as a hierarchy of spatial divisions, defined by the feudal order. These divisions gradually acquired solidity, crystallizing between about 1480 and 1580. While they could be combined into larger units, they could no longer be merged or dissolved into each other. New administrative subdivisions emerged that became equally rigid. These boundaries persisted well beyond 1806, in some cases to the present. Social and economic factors. Territorialization is associated with princes, but was only possible thanks to the demographic and economic growth since the 11th century that enabled lords to exploit land more intensively and extensively. Much of the empire remained covered in forest, and 12th century lords acquired more exclusive rights over these and other empty areas, and used the prerogatives granted by the emperor to command the labor needed to clear woodland, drain marshes, and plant wastes. The internal migration discussed in Chapter 2 was also part of this general situation. Changes in land use necessitated clearer boundaries to demarcate lordly authority and secure exclusive claims to labor and resources. Meanwhile, the greater concentration of wealth and people provided support for a larger and denser lordly hierarchy, especially in South and West Germany. The Staufer Charters of 1220 and 1231 accelerated an existing trend to fix authority in writing. The nascent princely elite began creating their own chancelleries from their personal chapel staff, like the emperor had done three centuries earlier. Cologne, the Palatinate, and Upper Bavaria all did this during the 13th century, being joined by Austria, 1299, and Württemberg, 1350. Most others only followed in the 15th century, including Saxony, 1428, Lower Hessen, 1469, and all larger territories after the 1480s. These bodies developed their own internal hierarchies and demarcation of function as their advisory role was transferred to separate court councils, which also assumed greater permanence around the mid-14th century. The chancellery's initial primary task was to maintain the feudal registers, Lehensbücher, appearing from 1220, and listing subordinate vassals and their obligations. The registers were expanded from the mid-14th century to record the issuing of charters and other key documents, and were soon supplemented by correspondence ledgers. These developments were rarely consistent, nor planned. Tyrol maintained financial accounts from 1288, but stopped this when it passed to the Habsburgs in 1363, and only resumed the practice in 1415. Territorialization was also related to the broader social transformation from aristocratic kindreds to patrilinear families, because the greater wealth both reduced mutual dependency whilst increasing the desire to demarcate exclusive shares. Like the emperors, princely families developed identities around castles, monasteries, and family tombs. The Margraves of Baden developed the Cistercian monastery of Lichtenfeld in 1248, which they used to bury their dead for the next 150 years as a focal point for their self-identity. One family's misfortune was often a boon to others, and the Margraves were fortunate to acquire additional territory through inheritance. Natural extinction ended the rise of the Ebersburgers in Bavaria, Conradiners in the Wetterau, and Esenitz on the Lower Rhine by the mid-11th century, dispersing their carefully accumulated lands to others. Indeed, the development of patrilinear families created smaller breeding groups, increasing the chances of extinction, though those chances were now usually only limited to individual branches. The demise of the Zähringer in 1218 halted the growth of a potentially powerful southwest German duchy, which was split between what became Baden, Fürstenberg, and the Swiss Confederation. Conversely, the longevity of individual rulers often contributed to territorialization. Count Eberhard I ruled Württemberg for 46 years after 1279, enabling him to exploit four changes of king to recover lands lost at the start of his reign to Rudolf I. Count Eberhard II's 48-year rule after 1344 then consolidated Württemberg and provided the basis for its subsequent elevation to a duchy. Unlike the emperor, lords holding immediate fiefs enjoyed greater powers to escheat lesser, mediate fiefs, enabling them to block potential local rivals by preventing anyone accumulating too many holdings. Meanwhile, the recovery of vacant mediate fiefs allowed lords to reward loyal clients by enfeoffing them. As a result, access to higher status grew more restricted, since it was difficult for lesser nobles to accumulate their own power base, which could support their personal elevation. The difficulty in securing sufficient land contributed to biological extinction. Only 10 of the 25 Styrian lordly Herren families in 1300 survived a century later, while those in Carinthia declined from 12 to 2 across 1286 to 1446. The number of Austrian lordly families fell from 33 in 1200 to 9 by 1450. Changes in the lower ranks were even greater. 118 lower Austrian knightly families died out between 1524 and 1574, followed by another 92 by 1625. Only 83 of the 259 Brandenburg noble families in 1540 were still represented in 1800. This reflected a natural process in pre-industrial Europe, because richer families fared better as they produced more children. Thus, while a status group might preserve its overall wealth, its composition could change significantly as the poorer families died out. Unless it opened its ranks to new members, such a group could face gradual extinction. The top stratum of the Bishop of Würzburg's vassals was the only one to grow, from 12 families in 1303 to 51 by 1519, whereas the total number of vassal families declined from 421 to 182 in the same period. Although the Würzburg mediate elite prospered, they and their equivalents elsewhere had no prospect of forming their own territories without first acquiring the status of immediacy through their own personal elevation, or the purchase or inheritance of an existing immediate fief. However, even counties offered only a restricted basis, since most of the large ones had already been raised as new principalities. Most of the counties that remained in the 14th century only comprised a castle, small town or large village, and some parcels of land. Rule here was more direct, since few counts had many mediate vassals of their own. Dynastic partitions eroded the potential of many counts' families on the Rhine, Main, and Danube. For instance, the county of Löwenstein was sold to the Palatinate in the mid-15th century, only to re-emerge after 1611 to accommodate junior lines of the Wittelsbachs. Counts declined in prestige as a group, because many counties passed into the hands of princes whose ranks were also growing. The counts of Gurz sold all their possessions to the Habsburgs between 1335 and 1500. By 1400, few of the families of counts had held that rank for more than a century, and none were viable contenders to be German king, in contrast to the position around 1300. Growing commercialization contributed to territorialization by eroding the original military function of vassalage and providing a way that additional fiefs could be acquired. Fiefs could be assessed in terms of cash values, derived from revenue streams or land prices, rather than in disparate forms of produce and bundles of rights and obligations. It became easier to transfer fiefs because it was clearer what was being sold and how much it should cost. This also helped resolve inheritance disputes without involving the emperor as arbitrator. Large fiefs were very expensive. Albrecht III sold his share of the Habsburg lands to his brother Leopold for 100,000 florins in 1379, while Sigismund transferred Brandenburg to Friedrich IV of Hohenzollern for four times that sum in 1415. Those with cash could develop and expand their territories. The Württemberg counts founded only seven towns, but bought three in the 13th century, 47 in the 14th, and 10 more in the 15th century. This example illustrates another general point, in that the counts bought land and lordships wherever these became available, as a means to amass wealth and influence, rather than to create a neat, compact territory. For example, they made extensive purchases in the 1320s in Alsace, a considerable distance across the Rhine from their county. Safeguarding these enclaves would haunt Württemberg rulers until they were finally lost in the French Revolutionary Wars. Although families generally tried to concentrate their acquisitions from the late 14th century, territorialization continued to follow the logic of the imperial status hierarchy, not modern geopolitical thinking. The intensification of vassalage and commercialization of fiefholding combined to create new subdivisions within princely jurisdictions. These, in turn, slowly gave fiefs greater geographical coherence. Dependent vassals became more closely associated with these subdivisions after the mid-13th century. Other factors assisted this, including the shift to patrilinear families based in castles, where the eldest male assumed responsibility for discharging obligations to the lord. The emergence of a more fixed parish structure also provided a handy means to define the shape of the subdivisions, which increasingly became known as districts, Ämter. This process was neither rational nor planned. Most princely jurisdictions remained a collection of subordinate fiefs. Large chunks of land often remained unincorporated within the district structure, in some cases into the 18th century. Districts were generally small, mostly only three or four parishes, but they never replaced villages and towns as the primary foci for inhabitants' identities. Nonetheless, districts slowly acquired greater coherence, especially as they developed more clearly as administrative units under district officials, Amtleute, or Amtmänner. Larger territories like Bavaria, Saxony, Styria, and the Palatinate created superior districts, Oberämter, as an additional coordinating layer between the center and localities. Again, variations remained. Officials in only 13 of the 40 to 45 districts in 16th century Brandenburg were directly appointed by the elector, with the rest comprising his sub-vassals, serving in that capacity under feudal obligations. By then, the district was the chief administrative unit in most territories, and its official received new powers in line with the expanding ambitions of princes to regulate ordinary life and to meet the new obligations imposed by imperial reform. Above all, districts provided the infrastructure required to collect taxes. Geldern, in northwest Germany, was unusual in already establishing a central treasury with its own accounts in 1290, in addition to the ledgers maintained by the districts. The other small Rhenish territories followed suit by 1350, but Austria and Bavaria were more typical in only doing this around 1500. Ecclesiastical territorialization. Ecclesiastical lords were initially ahead of their secular counterparts in developing the elements that eventually fused as territorialization. Bishops and abbots already lived apart from other clergy in their own residences by 900, followed by abbesses during the 12th century, adding to their sense of being by various definitions superior. The task of church building, together with the higher burdens imposed by medieval kings on the imperial church, encouraged the development of taxes well before these appeared in most secular fiefs. As we have heard, ecclesiastical lords were the first to employ ministeriales, circa 1020. Around a century later, these lords were building their own stone castles, like Aschaffenburg, 1122, and Erfurt, 1123. That were constructed to protect the Archbishop of Mainz's key possessions. Ecclesiastical lords also benefited from being based in towns, whereas few secular lordships possessed sizable towns prior to the later Middle Ages. Senior clerics had already developed traditions of being buried in their main church before most secular lords cultivated family tombs. However, ecclesiastical territorialization gathered pace precisely at a time when many cathedral towns escaped episcopal jurisdiction by securing recognition of their self-governance. Bishops retained control of the cathedral and usually some other important buildings, but otherwise lost the ability to command the inhabitants' wealth and labor. Although senior clergy developed a sense of transpersonal office, they were not hereditary rulers. The investiture dispute and papal schisms proved particularly disruptive, because rival popes frequently appointed their own bishops to the same see. Even under normal conditions, a new bishop often had to find his feet and cultivate local clients. Cathedrals and abbeys had their own administrations, known as chapters, staffed by canons, supported by benefices attached to the church. Chapters acquired additional resources and rights. For example, Henry IV allowed the chapter in Speyer to own property after 1101. Chapters considered themselves representatives of their church and had displaced lesser clergy and lay inhabitants from any role in selecting new bishops and abbots by the High Middle Ages. The position of chapters was strengthened by the outcome of the investiture dispute, which confirmed the principle of free election. The chapters developed along broadly similar lines to the empire's electoral college and entrenched their position by bargaining electoral agreements from prospective bishops and abbots from the 14th century. Innocent XII forbade further agreements after 1695, and though such contracts continued to be made, bishops were generally backed by the Pope and Emperor in the event of disputes. Moreover, canons frequently hoped to become bishops themselves, and so refrained from undermining episcopal powers too far. Ecclesiastical princes thus broadly followed their secular counterparts in adopting a more command style of governance from the later 17th century, complete with magnificent new palaces to display their status. Spiritual boundaries remained fairly stable, since they could only be altered with papal agreement, unlike the frequent partitions and changes in secular jurisdictions. However, the actual territory of bishops and abbots was always much smaller than their spiritual jurisdictions. Since it originated in gifts of crown land to the church, ecclesiastical territory was considered inalienable. Pieces were sold or pawned, but never on the scale witnessed with secular possessions, especially as the chapters always opposed alienation as threatening to their church. The Salians transferred numerous counties to church lords, while, as we have heard, Frederick II confirmed the bishop's possession of ducal powers, entailing judicial and military privileges equivalent to the secular prince's. The Staufer's demise ended the growth of ecclesiastical lands and jurisdictions, since no future monarchs were able to be so generous, while the spiritual character of abbots and bishops ensured that they could not accumulate further lands through inheritance. The subsequent viability of ecclesiastical territories therefore depended on how far they had been favored by earlier medieval rulers. Paderborn and Eichstätt remained poor, as did bishoprics and abbeys north of the Elbe, which were mostly later foundations which had had less time to acquire land than the longer established ones in the old core regions along the Rhine and Main. The relative vulnerability of many northern and eastern ecclesiastical territories also helps explain why they were already on their way to being secularized ahead of the Reformation. Ecclesiastical lords also appeared to be less potent patrons than their secular counterparts after 1250, and were often unable to prevent their vassals escaping their jurisdiction. Cologne is a prominent example. Since the 1060s, successive archbishops had amassed the extensive Terra Coloniensis across northwest Germany, consolidated by the grant of their new title as Duke of Westphalia in 1180. However, the counts took the opportunity of the Staufer's demise to emancipate themselves during the later 13th century. The defeat of Archbishop Siegfried von Westerburg of Cologne in the Battle of Vöhringen in 1288 proved a major setback, and though he continued to oppose his count's desires, those in Geldern, Jülich, Berg and Cleves all eventually secured their autonomy through the acquisition of ducal titles in the 14th century. A similar process occurred in the Archbishopric of Trier, where the counts of Luxembourg and Nassau escaped jurisdiction, while the Bishop of Würzburg found his acquisition of the old Franconian ducal title did not improve his position relative to neighboring secular lords. Mainz became hemmed in through the expansion of secular neighbors. The acquisition by the lords of Hessen of the Landgraviate of Thuringia in 1247 enabled them to develop a distinct territory, cutting that of Mainz in two by isolating the section around Erfurt from the main strip at the Rhine-Main nexus. Hessen was able to stop Mainz from summoning its inhabitants before episcopal courts after 1370. Mainz's refusal to grant similar concessions to the neighboring Palatinate led to a long and debilitating dispute that lasted from the 15th century into the 1660s. However, ecclesiastical lords were not invariably the losers. Margrave Albrecht Achilles of Bayreuth overreached himself in the mid-15th century when he tried to coerce local monasteries into accepting his protection, but fell deeply into debt when he was then blocked by the Bishop of Bamberg. Secular territorialization. The examples of Mainz, Hessen, and the Palatinate suggest we should not interpret territorialization as a linear process driven by a succession of rulers all working to the same plan. The Palatinate remained one of the most powerful territories of the later Middle Ages by relying on its electoral and palatine status and rights, rather than through amassing land. It owed its later influence to Barbarossa's transfer of the Count Palatine title to his half-brother, Conrad of Stauffen, in 1156, and the subsequent grant of former Salian estates in the Rhineland, and, especially, protectorates over Worms, Speyer, and Lorsch ecclesiastical properties. The royal estates at Alzey were transferred to the Palatinate in 1214, followed by fiefs acquired from Speyer and Worms. The latter included Heidelberg in 1225, which became the administrative seat. The Stauffer's demise ended these donations, ensuring that Palatine territorialization was closer to that of the ecclesiastical territories rather than hereditary secular duchies. Subsequent growth remained largely restricted to efforts at converting the Palatinate's bundles of jurisdictions over knights, towns, and monasteries into more immediate forms of control. Thuringia's example also illustrates how territorialization was never a simple process of consolidation. Originally, the area of the Thuringi, who had been conquered by the Franks in 534, Thuringia was bounded by the Harz Mountains and the Unstrut, Werra, and Saale rivers. In addition to Erfurt, which belonged to Mainz, the region contained the important imperial abbeys of Fulda and Hersfeld. The accession of the Ottonians in 919 transformed it from a border zone to a core region, soon endowed with important palaces. The Ludovinger family of counts, based at Schauenburg, became the dominant local presence under the Salians, and were awarded the title of Landgrave in 1130. Barbarossa rewarded Ludovinger support by giving them the Palatine powers formerly associated with Ducal Saxony, which he stripped from Henry the Lion in 1180. These powers were similar to those of the Counts Palatine on the Rhine, and gave the Thuringian Landgrave opportunities to cultivate his own clientele. The Ludovinger family inherited additional property in Hessen, protected by the castle of Marburg, as well as the castles of Neuburg on the Unstrut and the Wartburg, the latter made famous in 1517, when Luther nailed his 95 Theses on its chapel door. So far, Thuringia's development fitted the classic pattern of gradual accumulation and consolidation. It was sufficiently advanced for Landgrave Heinrich Rasper to be considered worthy of election as anti-Stauffer king in 1246. However, Thuringia was not coherent enough to survive his death a year later, as this opened a prolonged inheritance dispute that eventually pulled it apart. Hessen passed as a separate territory to the Counts of Brabant, who were awarded a Landgrave title in 1292. The rest passed to the Wettin family as Counts of Meissen, who managed to repel royal efforts to escheat it as a vacant fief between 1294 and 1307. The Wettins resumed the earlier consolidation, but were unable to reassert control over the lords of Gleichen, Henneberg, Reuss, and Schwarzburg, who had meanwhile gained autonomy. The Wettins acquired the Saxon ducal title from the defunct Wittenberg branch of the Ascania in 1423, but split their possessions in 1485, separating the electorate of Saxony to the east from the Rump of Thuringia, which was subsequently partitioned as the Saxon duchies of Weimar, Gotha, and Coburg after 1572, followed by further subdivisions during the next two centuries. Partitions were a constant feature, indicating the very slow acceptance of dynasticism as a political principle. The Welfs split in 1267, barely 3 decades after the establishment of their new duchy at Brunswick, and multiple lines persisted until 1918. Hessen repeatedly split into upper and lower sections after 1308. With this division becoming permanent, with the establishment of separate lines based in Kassel and Darmstadt in 1567. Baden's initial expansion stalled in repeated partitions after 1190, with only a brief reunification from 1475 to 1536, until the various sections were finally concentrated in 1771. Other families divided their lands without such serious repercussions for their subsequent influence. The Habsburgs, Wittelsbachs, Hohenzollerns, and, to an extent, the Wettins. Jülich's steady expansion on the Lower Rhine was thus highly unusual. Its dukes successively acquired Geldern, Berg, Ravensburg, Cleves, and Mark between 1393 and 1521. Its demise was rather more typical. Biological extinction of the ruling line opened what proved the last inheritance dispute accompanied by serious violence between 1609 and 1614. Other than that over the Austrian succession, 1740 to 1748, which was an altogether different affair. Jülich's example also demonstrates the growing rigidity of fiefs, since its expansion occurred after feudal jurisdictions had acquired more stable identities and boundaries. Each fief retained its own laws and institutions as it was acquired by the Duke of Jülich, who held fiefs as a personal union rather than integrated territory. The growing significance of mediate fiefs. The inheritance or transfer of immediate fiefs affected their mediate, dependent vassals as well. Territories thus remained composites comprising three elements. 1. The allodial possessions of the ruling family in secular principalities, or lands attached to the cathedral and chapter in ecclesiastical ones. 2. The possessions of territorial subjects, subject to their prince's legal and fiscal jurisdiction. And 3. The mediate vassals' fiefs. The exact mix varied considerably, while jurisdictions frequently did not entirely align with land ownership. For example, ecclesiastical princes exercised spiritual jurisdiction across the lands of their secular neighbors, while princes might share rights or hold different levels of criminal jurisdiction over parts of their possessions. Crucially, fief holding retained political and military significance across the 14th and 15th centuries and did not simply become another form of land ownership, unlike in France and England, where lords responded to the new economic pressures by converting many of their obligations into cash payments. Instead, the periodic struggles to control the German crown required that princes and their vassals remain armed. Armed retaliation through feuds remained a legal way to seek redress under imperial law, while lordship over mediate vassals offered an effective way to expand influence in the conditions of the later 13th century. The Staufers' last decade saw serious fighting in much of the empire, while the kings after 1257 were rarely able to help their lesser vassals. The ministeriales and knights, charged with administering crown lands and protecting imperial abbeys, were usually too weak to fend for themselves. Many placed themselves under the protection of neighboring bishops or secular princes, notably the Count Palatine and the Dukes of Bavaria. This process continued even as the general political situation stabilized after 1273, because the agrarian depression setting in around 1300 adversely affected the lesser vassals. Many of those who were still free, meaning immediate under the king, now voluntarily placed themselves under princely protection and became mediate vassals. The new understanding of property greatly facilitated this, because the knights retained rights of usage of their fiefs. Often, these arrangements included princely confirmation of new forms of inheritance, allowing the knight to exclude daughters and other relations in future. Overall, these developments hastened the merger of the ministeriales within the lesser nobility, either as knights who remained free under the king, or as a new social estate of territorial nobles, Land Adel, under a prince. These changes were often accompanied by considerable violence at the local level, because they involved clarifying exactly who was subordinate to whom and what rights and land each noble held. Princes also used the new powers acquired in the 1220 and 1231 charters, which allowed them to decide who was allowed to build castles and to oblige their vassals to open their own castles to them. Princes often deliberately manipulated personal and material animosities to extend lordship over a rival's mediate vassals. Nobles responded by forming associations to defend their status and autonomy. Princes could offer cash subsidies to cover the cost of service as inducements to entice vassals to switch allegiance. They also broke up their own allodial property to form new fiefs that could be granted to clients. Although still useful, the term territorialization is thus in many ways a misnomer. Rather than the coloured patches shown on later historical atlases, princely territories expanded largely as webs of jurisdictions. Coalescence was often interrupted by the extinction of families or their partition into different branches, as well as more fundamentally by the economic and demographic upheavals of the first half of the 14th century. True territorialization, as conceived by later historians, only really commenced with the political and institutional changes of imperial reform during the later 15th and 16th centuries, as we shall find out. From little kings to big dynasties, the end of the Staufers. Territorialization advanced further and faster in Bavaria, Austria, Tyrol, Bohemia, and parts of West and Northwest Germany. These were neither necessarily the richest nor most populous parts of the empire. The prolonged royal presence in Franconia, Swabia, the Upper Rhine, and parts of Thuringia contributed to the number of small fiefs emerging from the crown lands, while the concentration of people and wealth in the southwest also helped sustain a larger number of relatively small lordships. The Staufer's demise after 1250 saw the monarchy shift to the more territorialized parts of Germany. At first glance, this appears to corroborate the old view of the empire as being undermined by princely autonomy. However, the Staufer's end was more personal than structural. After a 15-year absence in Italy and the Holy Land, Frederick II had returned to Germany in 1235, accompanied by lavishly dressed Muslim bodyguards, camels, and elephants, the ultimate symbol of pre-modern imperialism. Despite not recruiting additional troops, he crushed a rebellion without a fight, deposed his son, Henry (VII), and Duke Friedrich II Babenberg of Austria, and settled the long-running dispute with the Welfs. The real problem was legitimacy, not autonomy. The princes certainly desired autonomy, but this is what the Staufers had been giving them since the 1180s. Individual princes might prove uncooperative, like Duke Friedrich II, who recovered Austria by force in 1237, and obliged the emperor to accept this 3 years later as the price of his support. However, it was Frederick's mishandling of the situation in Italy and his second excommunication after 1239 that undermined his authority and made it harder to compel the princes to honor their commitments to the empire. The survival of the monarchy. The period from the death of Frederick II's son Conrad IV in 1254 and Rudolf I's accession in 1273 appears as an interregnum in traditional accounts. The papacy certainly regarded the imperial title as vacant until Henry VII's coronation in 1312. However, there was no break in German kings, who, throughout, also claimed to rule over Burgundy and Italy. Indeed, there were often too many kings. The anti-king, William of Holland, outlived Conrad IV to enjoy 2 years uncontested rule. The double election after his death returned both Alfonso X of Castile and Richard, Earl of Cornwall, who had Staufer credentials through being Frederick II's brother-in-law. Unlike Alfonso, who never visited Germany, Richard came to be crowned king in Aachen in May 1257. He distributed privileges to his supporters, but also used force against those who had backed Alfonso. He was obliged in 1259 to return to England, where deteriorating relations between his brother King Henry III and the barons threatened the flow of funds financing his rule. He came back briefly to Germany in 1260, before leaving to support his brother in the Barons' War, in which he was captured. German princes continued to visit him in England, while his supporters successfully repelled an incursion of Conradin, the last Staufer, from Italy into Swabia in 1262. The Angevins' execution of Conradin in 1268 eased Richard's position, just as he was at last able to return to Germany, where he spent around a year enjoying uncontested rule before being obliged to leave for England again, where he died in April 1272. Richard retained the feudal relations developed by the Staufers, as well as several key officials who had served William of Holland. The idea of Richard's reign as an interregnum only developed after 1273, as Rudolf I's supporters presented him as restoring the monarchy. The 75 years after Richard's death proved an era of leaping elections, springenden Wahlen, with 5 successive kings from different families, until greater continuity emerged under the Luxembourgs. In contrast to previous monarchs, these were all little kings, unrelated to earlier royal lines, and they came instead mainly from the ranks of the counts. Their low status should not mislead us into underestimating the continued power and prestige of the empire's monarchy. Apparent royal weakness was scarcely unusual. In Richard's homeland, Edward I was the sole king to rule uncontested during the 12th and 13th centuries, while only 3 English kings were succeeded directly by their sons, and just 1 ruled without an assassination attempt. Above all, the royal office never became a worthless prize in the manner of, say, the Chinese presidency in the warlord era of 1911 to 1930, and those possessing it were able to achieve tangible goals. One reason for the monarchy's continued significance was that it was part of a wider framework in which the other participants still believed and valued. The king symbolized the proper order. Individual details might be disputed, but no one doubted that a proper order was monarchical. Aachen and Frankfurt remained the key political sites. The empire did not fragment. Duke Friedrich II's attempt to secure recognition of Austria as a kingdom failed in the mid-1240s. Bohemia remained a kingdom, but also firmly within the empire. Continued subordination to the king was not simply out of habit, but because the empire's survival had become part of the prince's self-consciousness. Individuals might acquire crown lands, but no one could usurp royal prerogatives without threatening the rights and autonomy of all princes as the monarch's immediate vassals. Despite the absence of a crowned emperor, the princes still saw themselves as part of the wider empire, rather than simply lords of what were still relatively small territories. They embraced the Staufer's concept of collective honor imperii, because feudalization had heightened their sense of being stakeholders in the established order. This explains why they were prepared to cooperate with the resumption of the Staufer's public peace activities by Richard and Rudolf. New ideas of the prince's roles were carried by men educated at Italian universities, who were now entering royal and princely service. Princes were not simply royal agents following commands, but members of a corporate elite expected to act on their own initiative to secure peace within their jurisdictions. Although still subordinate, princes were thus co-constituents of monarchy, not counterweights to potential monarchical tyranny as elsewhere. This explains why the empire's princes did not develop a right of resistance like Polish or Hungarian aristocrats, nor did they seek to limit royal power through more institutional forms, like a House of Lords in the English, Polish, or Hungarian parliaments. Another major reason was that the three senior princes were all ecclesiastical: Mainz, Cologne, and Trier. As clergy, they could not stand as candidates in royal elections, and yet their own prestige derived from their arch offices and roles in elections and coronations. Apart from 1257, when Trier broke ranks, contributing to the double election, the three ecclesiastical electors worked to preserve the collective order. Meanwhile, the deliberate partition of the old duchies after Henry the Lion's defeat in 1180 prevented the emergence of an obvious candidate to follow the Staufers after 1254, since none of the secular princes held a commanding position. The situation embedded as a lasting characteristic of imperial politics. All the main actors wanted to preserve the overall structure whilst adjusting their own position within it. They tended to combine against anyone threatening this system's basic stability. While self-correcting, the internal balance was far from harmonious. It was now much harder to pick a winner in royal elections, as no contender appeared much stronger than his rivals after 1250. This widened the political possibilities as different factions coalesced in the hope of security and reward. The absence of firm electoral rules prior to 1356 also encouraged this and contributed to the double elections of 1257 and 1314. Each new king exploited his reign to reward his most reliable supporters, but particularly himself, by enhancing the autonomy of his own territory. This naturally fueled resentment amongst those who had backed defeated candidates, and contributed to their refusal to repeat the practice before 1250 of recognizing a successor during the lifetime of an incumbent king. This explains the succession of kings from different families after 1254. However, there was no free-for-all. The situation worked to narrow rather than widen the number of viable candidates. Despite their expansion under the Staufers, the princes remained a small elite within a much larger aristocracy. Most were simply too weak to stand for election, especially as potential electors did not want to become obliged to bail out their candidate should he encounter difficulties, and so they still sought able men with considerable resources. Although they failed to secure a direct successor, each incumbent generally strengthened his own family's position during his reign, thus elevating it further from those who had not yet provided a king.